At this time, the conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. I'd like to turn it over to your speakers. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So welcome to the November Charm Telecon. We're fortunate to be joined by three members of the INMS team. INMS is the ion and neutral mass spectrometer on Cassini. And the team lead for that instrument is Hunter Waite, and the team is based at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. And Hunter's not going to be with us today, but he sent three capable scientists, and they're going to talk about different topics that INMS has contributed to. As is typical on Cassini, sometimes the in-situ instruments get a bit of a short shrift. I work on the magnetometer and the dust detector, and these types of instruments have contributed hugely to the scientific output of Cassini, and INMS is one of those instruments that's done that as well, in particular in our understanding of Titan's atmosphere, the plume at Enceladus, topics like that. So the three scientists that we have are Brian McGee, Joseph Westlake, Joe, who's also a doctoral student at the University of Texas at San Antonio, as well as working at Southwest Research, and Ben Teolis. I hope I said your last name right.
Yes.
And I think Brian is going to start, and they're going to cover topics that pertain to Titan and Enceladus, and they're kind of going to do a bit of a tag team approach. So they'll go back and forth between speakers, and if they want to tell us any more about their scientific interests or background as the Charm Telecon goes on, that's great. I'd also like to suggest that you download the PowerPoint presentation. There are a couple of animations that, you know, were slightly degraded in the PDF version of the presentation. And I think they're happy to take questions during the talk, so if you want to ask, just interrupt, identify yourself, and ask your question. So with that, I'll hand it over to Brian McGee. Brian?
Thank you very much, Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, my name is Brian McGee. I've been working on INMS science analysis since 2004, since the first Titan flyby. And I'll let both Ben and Joe introduce themselves briefly here at the beginning.
Ben Teolis, a research scientist here at Southwest Research Institute, also heavily involved in the INMS measurements at Enceladus.
Joseph Westlake, I'm a doctoral student at University of Texas San Antonio. I work here at Southwest Research as well. I'm in my fourth year of my PhD program, working on observations of Titan and Enceladus. So I'll hand it back to Brian.
Okay. Now that we've gone over our brief introductions, I'll just tell you a bit about the instrument. So if you go to the first real slide, slide two.
Hey, Brian, can I interrupt already?
Sure.
There seems like there's a bit of noise on the line. I don't know if it's coming from your end. It just went away.
Really?
I think it might be you guys. Well, we can't isolate you and take you offline, so we'll just have to live with it. If there's anyone else out there who's got some noise in their area, please mute your phone, star six. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Brian.
I think it might be our projector.
Okay, we'll just live with it.
Okay, well, I apologize for that, everybody. Okay, so first I'll just tell you a bit about the INMS instrument. If you're on, you should be on slide two by now, and you should see a schematic of the Cassini INMS. INMS stands for the Ion and Neutral Mass Spectrometer, and it was built to measure neutral and ion composition in situ during flybys of Saturn's moons, primarily Titan. Enceladus was a bit of a surprise, and we'll get to that in the latter half of the presentation. So we take data continuously throughout the tour of Saturn's system, but typically, we're only sensitive to cast densities seen during close flybys of these moons. And if you look at a schematic, you'll see that there are two sources on the INMS, which allows us to measure both ions and neutrals. We use the open source, which is at the bottom, to detect ions, and the closed source, which is above, to measure neutrals. You'll see that the closed source has an antechamber, which is built so that it may accept in a maximum amount of gas over a wide angular range. This allows us to take more data or more viable data during flybys which don't have ideal pointing for INMS. The open source, however, has a much smaller angular acceptance, which is based primarily on the ability of the instrument to control incoming ions. So we get less ion measurements and have to do that primarily when Cassini dictates that it's an INMS-centric flyby. If you go on to the next slide, slide 3, you'll see some actual data from INMS. Now, as Marcia said before, we're an in-situ instrument, and we don't take pictures of pretty pictures of Titan and Enceladus. So in an effort to make our data look a little bit sexier, we color-code it like this. And it also allows it to be understood a little bit easier. So what you see is an ion spectrum on the top and a neutral spectrum on the bottom. These are both taken at Titan during a really close flyby, during T16. What you'll see is that you have these correlated families of species in both the ions and the neutrals, and we'll get to that a little bit later, what that all means. But first, I'll talk a little bit about how we actually detect these ions and the neutrals. I was talking before about the neutrals, having the closed-source antichamber allows in a wider range of acceptance. But first, I'll talk about the ions. The ions come in to the open source. They are positively charged to begin with, so they come through the aperture. They go through a series of focusing lenses, and which propagates them towards the mass analyzer, which is the quadrupole. This essentially acts like a filter in which we can say we want to detect species of only a certain mass at a time. So we can only look at a singular mass at any given instant. Now, the neutrals are a little bit more difficult. Since they're not charged yet, we have to propagate them towards an ionization source. And so first what they do is they come into through the aperture, into the antechamber, they thermally equilibrate with the walls, and then they propagate down a transfer tube towards the ionization source. We then ionize them with electron impact with an electron gun. And once they're ionized, we can then control them and how they propagate through the rest of the system towards the mass analyzer and towards the detector. If you'll go to the next slide, slide 4, I'll talk a little bit about how we actually analyze the data. So our analysis returns depend highly on the data viability, depending on a wide range of things, instrument artifacts, the amount of densities that we're actually seeing, and the types of gas. Calibration in information, how well we've calibrated all these different species and the instrument artifacts as well. And then the complexity of the species mix, as well as a priori knowledge of the sample. The more complex the species mix is, the more we have some ambiguities, and I'll talk about that just now. When we ionize the neutrals, not only are we making parents, not only are we stripping off an electron and ionizing the parent molecule, but we also make dissociative products as well. Sometimes the ionization energy with the electron impacting against the molecule actually fragments the parent molecule. And this is shown below in a schematic that we have with the electron impact dissociation. You have the first one example is N2, a relatively simple example. You have an electron impacts N2, you create not only N2 plus, but also some N plus as the nitrogen bonds are being broken apart. Slightly more complex is with CH4 being methane. Not only are you actually getting CH4 plus, but also you're stripping off a hydrogen here and there, getting CH3 plus, CH2 plus, C plus, H2 plus, you're getting a wide range of products there. And on the right-hand side, you can see what the mass spectrum of just CH4 looks like. You take that to the extreme end of the spectrum for us, since we only measure things up to 100 Daltons, you see benzene, C6H6, and you have over 30 different products. So at Titan, at Enceladus, when we're actually measuring these a mix of species, we get a lot of things that overlap because our resolution is actually only at one Dalton. So anything that's showing up at mass 28, for example, is going to be competing with nitrogen gas. N2 is going to be there. C2H4 is going to be there because it also adds up to 28 Daltons and so on. If you click once, you'll see an example of this analysis difficulty at Titan. Prime example is the C2 organic group. As I was just saying, at Titan, mass 28 is dominated by nitrogen, the most abundant species in Titan's atmosphere. But we also see a host of organics. And the C2 group has C2H2, C2H4, C2H6, as well as hydrogen cyanide. And because they're so similar in their mass spectrum, they occupy all the same mass channels, which makes it very difficult to actually isolate any individual species. So we have to play some analysis games in order to deconvolve the spectrum and see what's actually going on there. If you go to the next slide, you can see the full spectrum mass deconvolution at Titan. On the top left is a spectrum from that's summed over all the flybys during the Cassini nominal mission. That's 20 different flybys that had viable INMS data for INMS. That's summed from 1,000 kilometers to 1,100 kilometers. The histogram is actually the co-added spectrum, and the red dots indicate our forward model of what that mass deconvolution actually is based on our calibration data. What you can see on the right-hand side is that there's a ton of species there, a really rich mixture of organics. What we're seeing is that there's a lot of things that are there that aren't seen by the remote sensing instruments lower down in the atmosphere. And what this means is that a lot of what's going on is happening in the upper atmosphere. This, the chemistry is all being driven, or mostly being driven up there. And not only are we seeing just the composition, but we can also get altitude profiles of these densities. From those altitude profiles, we can figure out what these chemical mechanisms are going through to produce the species that we're actually observing. If you go on to the next slide, you'll see, which is slide 6, you'll see on the top left-hand side is an inset of our determination of benzene, or the mass spectrum that, according to benzene from INMS. And the red dots there show forward model of what a benzene spectrum looks like from our calibration data. And a big discovery for us at Titan was the presence of these complex organics, like benzene and toluene. Some of these complex species are found on the surface of Titan, but what we know is that the upper atmosphere plays a critical role in forming much of this material that ends up comprising the organic grains that cover the surface in these immense dunes, which you've no doubt seen from radar and VIMS. On the right-hand side, you can see a picture that shows these vast dark regions that are representative of the dunes, primarily at mid-latitude on the Titan surface. And in the VIMS reflectance spectrum, if you click once on your PowerPoint slide, you can see that they observe benzene that's concentrated around the area of these dunes. So this is a prime example of multiple Cassini instruments working together to put together a story of what's going on at Titan. And here I'm going to pass it off to Joe Westlake, who's going to talk a little bit more about the chemistry.
Thanks, Brian. So if we move on to slide 7, I'll talk a little bit about Titan's upper atmospheric chemistry. If we look again at the figure on the left, you can see the ion spectrum and the neutral spectrum as measured by INMS. The link between the ion and neutral molecules in Titan's upper atmosphere is clear from the comparison of these two spectra. At the top, the ion spectrum shows great complexity, and shows several groups all the way up to the C7 hydrocarbon group. At the bottom, we see the same. In general, the process of this complex organic molecular growth proceeds as shown in the figure to the right. Basically, the gist of this is that solar photons and energetic protons and electrons from Saturn's magnetosphere drive the dissociation and ionization of methane and molecular nitrogen. The primary dissociative and ionized products will then react with each other through ion molecule reactions, which have been shown to be very fast and, in general, will grow complex organic material. So the link here is clear, and it's also very important in the production of these solens or these very complex aromatics. So if we move on to the next slide, I'll take you through a flyby as observed by the Cassini plasma spectrometer, the CAPS IBS, as well as the INMS. So you'll see right now on the slide an arrow. Altitude. As you click through the first slide, you'll see a spectrum come up, and that's representative of a CAPS spectrum at 1,419 kilometers in Titan's upper atmosphere. You'll see in the white is the CAPS IBS spectrum. Now, CAPS measures energy per charge of ions that are incident on the instrument. We can convert that to a mass per charge spectrum, knowing that the ionospheric ions are cold and that the Cassini velocity is fast in comparison. And that correlation is quite easy, and you can do it through a direct fitting between the INMS and the CAPS IBS. So seen here is CAPS IBS in white and INMS fitted to the CAPS IBS in blue. So as we click through, we go to 1,270 kilometers. You can see the complexity increases. We see more hydrocarbon peaks and more of these complex hydrocarbons rising up in density. Going down further, you'll see at the 1,172 level a red spectrum start to show up, and that's representative of masses greater than 100 daltons. So we're seeing very complex hydrocarbons that are produced in this sort of process. So as we continue down to closest approach at 1080 and 1025 kilometers, you'll see the red spectrum becomes almost equivalent in density to the blue portion of the spectrum. So at some point, these high-mass ions actually begin to dominate the spectrum, or at least become equivalent in density to the low-mass components. And it seems that this process is purely an ion-neutral process that's building these complex hydrocarbons in ways that we haven't seen before. So then we move down through the 988 kilometers, the closest approach, and back up. You'll see the ions reduce in density until we, again, come back to the level 1210 and 1334 kilometers that we saw at the 1419 kilometers beginning. So if you click through that entire slide, I know it's a lot of clicks, and appreciate you hanging with me through it. So we can move on to the next slide of Titan's nitrogen photochemistry. Seen on the left is a scheme, a chemical scheme, that shows how the dissociation of methane and nitrogen drives the ion neutral chemistry. You'll see that methane is dissociated into four products, CH, excited state CH2, CH2, and CH3, and that nitrogen is dissociated and ionized into three species, a nitrogen species and two ionized, N+ and N2+. This then drives the chemistry into the C2 aromatics, or excuse me, the C2 hydrocarbons, ethylene, HCN, and also drives the primary ion production of C2H5+, HCNH+, and CH3+. Seen on the right is a very important bit of work that has shown that specifically the nitrogen photochemistry drives the aromatic production. You'll see the figure shows a nitrogen-methane mix that's been irradiated by several different wavelengths of photons. So the At the bottom, the UV photons are turned off, and you'll see just N2 and CH4. The 121.6 nanometers shows a photon that's energetic enough to dissociate methane. 85 nanometers is representative one of a photon that's energetic enough to ionize methane. And you'll see at 60 nanometers, you have a photon that's energetic enough to ionize nitrogen. This is the work done by Emanaka and Smith. And you'll see that the nitrogen, specifically the ionization of nitrogen, results in aromatic production, specifically benzene and toluene, as they observe in the spectrum. If you click through, I've highlighted that pathway in which N2 is ionized to N2+, which reacts with CH4 to produce CH3+, which then promotes this complex organic growth. So we'll move to the next slide, slide 10, where you'll see a schematic of the benzene formation. This was shown in a science paper by Hunter Waite in 2007. The primary ions in Titan's ionosphere, C2H5+, HCNH+, and CH5+, which are all protonated version, or molecules which have been given an extra proton, of primary neutral components within the ionosphere, so ethylene, hydrogen cyanide, and methane. These products then react with acetylene, diacetylene, C2H2, and C4H2 to produce the C4 group ions, C4H5 and C4H3+. These then react with C2H4 with ethylene to produce the C6H7+ and C6H5+. These ions then will dissociatively recombine with an electron, an ambient electron, to produce the benzene observed. So this is a consistent model that reproduces the benzene densities that we've observed in the neutrals. So it's clear that the ion neutral chemistry is very important in the growth of large hydrocarbons. We move to the next slide. I've shown the positive ions and a representative spectrum of the positive ions. We see masses up to roughly 350 Daltons, very, very complex, large hydrocarbons. And at the top, you'll see the INMS spectrum overlaid, so we can see how INMS sees this. On the right, it's also important to notice that the CAPS electron spectrometer sees negative ions, very large masses, some say up to 10,000 Daltons or AMU per charge. These contribute as well, though their composition and production processes are not very well known. So we then move on to the next slide, slide number 12, excuse me, where we see at the top a table, which I'll come to in a second, which is produced from the figure in the lower right, the percent occurrence. What we've done is we've taken a statistical group of or a representative group of the high mass ion spectra. We've then located the peaks within these spectra and then determined their occurrence within the spectrum. Very high and very likely peaks are representative of a high percent occurrence on this graph. So it's interesting that the percent occurrence is very tightly grouped, and that it's centric around peaks that occur every 12 to 14 Daltons, which is what we'd expect from what we saw in the low mass spectrum. It also leads us to believe that they're mostly hydrocarbons and nitrogen substituted hydrocarbons, which brings us to the figure in the upper left. What we've done is we've taken a catalog of possible ion species from several different sources and compared them to our percent occurrence or our peak finder here. And it's clear that the most likely compounds are aromatic and that, in general, the polycyclic aromatic polymers or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are very likely, and nitrogen-substituted hydrocarbons are also quite likely, though from what we saw in the lower mass portions are not quite as likely as pure hydrocarbons. Also, it's clear that aliphatic copolymers are possible as well. So we move to slide 13, where I will hand it back to Brian, and he'll discuss a little bit about Enceladus.
All right, so
we talked about Titan so far, which was primarily what Cassini INMS was built for. And now we're going to shift towards Enceladus. As I'm sure you've heard, Enceladus has been a real treat for Cassini scientists. You can see from the great picture in the top left of the slide that there are distinct surface fractures near the South Pole that run parallel to each other, and which have been termed the Tiger Stripes. When we were first analyzing INMS data from the first close flyby of Enceladus in 2005, we were struck by the unexpected gas densities observed of water. It turns out that the South Pole is significantly warmer than the rest of the body, and the heat is centered about these fractures, as seen by the temperature map on the right-hand side. A visible plume of the gas and dust is emitted from this region, driven out of several distinct jets identified by Cassini scientists. If you move on to slide 14, you're going to be viewing you'll see a slide that's going to give you an animated view of a Cassini flyby of Enceladus from the perspective of INMS. We first see a cartoon version of possible subsurface scenarios. First, a subsurface ocean with a rocky core on the left-hand side, and a rock ice mix with interstitial water on the right-hand side. The former seems the more likely, though the depth of the ocean here is a bit exaggerated in the cartoon. But what the INMS team observes in the plume, we know that there's some subsurface chemistry going on that's driving the complexity of the plume composition. After clicking once, you'll see the figure zoom out, and then you're going to see an image of Cassini actually flying by over the plumes of Enceladus. And then what's going to pop up is a color-coded histogram that shows the plume's composition as processed by our analysis team. As I discussed before, it's not quite as easy as the figure makes it look, but we'll talk about that a little bit more in the next slide. If you go to the next slide, slide 15, we have compiled here some information about all the Enceladus flybys, though in the past few weeks we have had a few more encounters which have not yet been fully analyzed. The first thing to note here is that the signal taken during each of the plume observations shows a mass spectrum that's quite regular. The families of these mass peaks show up again and again with very similar structure. The signal amplitude is a function of distance from the South Polar source region, as well as spacecraft pointing and speed with respect to Enceladus. When the INMS is not pointed within, say, 30 degrees of the target sample, we get both less signal and the accuracy of our density calculations deteriorate. So we can only actually look at E2 barely and E3 and E5 as far as composition is concerned. But what E4 and E6 also tell us is that we're still seeing the same structure composition-wise. We just can't get accurate densities. With the higher velocity with respect to the sample, we have an increase in our signal. However, there's a problem that these increased velocities, since they're so large, actually incur some instrument effects that are associated with energetic impact of the dissociation of the incoming molecules when they encounter the walls of the antechamber. So what we actually see is some things like H2O and CO2, for example, coming in so fast and with so much energy that when they hit the titanium walls of the antechamber and before they thermally equilibrate, they actually dissociate into fragments. And we have to take that into account in addition to the fragmenting from electron impact ionization. If you proceed to slide 16, you'll see on the left-hand side that mass spectrum again, the color-coded one, and also on the right-hand side a quite extensive table of all the species that we see and present upper limits for based on our observation. This past summer, our group published our findings from the latest flybys in Nature, and we're about to get into some of that now. But if you'd like a lot more detail, I suggest looking into that letter. So here we present some of the composition as taken from the E5 flyby, which is the produced the highest signal that we have yet to date. Back in 2005, when we were first analyzing the first Enceladus data set, we took notice that the composition was quite analogous to a comet. So in the subsequent analyses on this better signal, we have included common cometary constituents. We've also included possible products of chemical processes, as well as everything that we see at Titan. What we end up seeing is a plume that's dominated by water, naturally, followed by a significant contribution of carbon dioxide, methane, and organics. It's fascinating that we see even more species, likely oxygenated compounds that are not seen at Titan, which are frequently found in comets. So this discovery backs up our previous finding and helps drive deeper comparisons, which will be discussed in a few more slides. We are going to point out a couple of important species here, ammonia and radiogenic argon, which are key to understanding what's actually going on at Enceladus. To click to the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about ammonia. Finding ammonia in the plume helps us to put together an idea of what may be going on underneath Enceladus' icy surface. Ammonia in the spectrum is seen as a residual deficiency, actually, and not completely clear like water, since water is the dominant signal. But what we can tell is that when there's water and there's some methane, no matter what else we decide to put into the spectrum, we decide to model with other organics, there's a deficiency in masses 16 and 17, which is clearly identifying ammonia. So without this addition of ammonia, the model is approximately 3 sigma in disagreement from the observed signal. That's our indication that it's actually there. Ammonia, together with methanol and salts, permit the existence of liquid water down to as low as 176 degrees Kelvin. These first two chemicals are both positively identified by INMS in the plume from these recent flybys. The salts have been found by the Cassini Dust Analyzer team, and I believe Frank Postberg detailed that work in a CHARM talk this past August. So now that we have an indication that there's possibly some liquid water, we can say what else is going on. What does that mean? Well, with this preserved oceanic layer, it's possible to maintain the conditions necessary for renewed episodes of tidal heating and the geological activity which could be producing some of these species, actually making some of these more complex organics. Additionally, the abundance of ammonia gives us an idea of where all the nitrogen in the Enceladus system came from. Nitrogen and primordial argon are trapped by clathrates with a similar efficiency. So the low upper limit that's set by INMS on primordial argon tells us that, or at least with respect to the relative amount of nitrogen-bearing species that we do detect, tells us that it's most likely that ammonia is the major carrier of nitrogen in the material that formed Enceladus. If you go on to slide 18, I'm going to talk about argon now. Now that we've shown that there's some indication that there may be liquid water underneath the surface of Enceladus, we can figure out we can put the argon in better context. So the signals seen in the mass spectrum from 35 to 46 Daltons on the top left-hand side is first dominated by carbon dioxide, the second most abundant species at Enceladus. The rest of it is dominated by see-through organics, propene and propane. With our best fit spectrum, we are again left with a significant residual that's only there at mass 40 only. There are other organic species that do produce and present some signal at mass 40. However, in order to take up the residual, they would reduce the fit in other mass channels, several other mass channels. So it seems that mass 40 alone indicates that there's a presence of this radiogenic 40 argon. This radiogenic argon is actually decayed 40 potassium, a material for which we can actually estimate an abundance based on the amount of rock that's that comprises Enceladus. But based on this estimation of how much potassium there is, we actually observe quite a bit more 40-argon than we would expect. So this means that there has to be some sort of mechanism to concentrate the argon that we do see from out of the rock and into the material that's sourcing these plumes. Below, we show that with a pure ice, there's no way to get the argon or concentrate what's already there. If you had in some liquid water, there's possibly some argon already in the liquid, but there's no mechanism for there's a mechanism for concentrating it, but not a mechanism for actually replenishing it, leaching it from the from something else. Only if you have liquid water, ice, and rock all interacting together, you have a way of both leaching and then concentrating the argon into the liquid, allowing for the sort of abundances that we actually observe. Additionally, it's possible the plume could be it could be accessing material that's degassing clathrate hydrate from this argon-enriched ocean. But regardless, our findings indicate that either the argon observed by INMS is not steady state, or that the plume activity is intermittent, somewhere around a 1% duty cycle. And this is not completely understood, but it shows that Enceladus is quite an interesting body. To proceed to slide 19, I talk a little bit more about other species here and talk about some of the difficulties in the analysis of Enceladus specifically. So there are some notable ambiguities. First, as I mentioned before, we have the problem that there's this energetic impact association. First, since carbon dioxide is the second most abundant species, when you ionize it, it has a primary product of carbon monoxide at mass 28. But we're unable to detect how much additional carbon monoxide there may be because of this energetic impact association. We know that there would be additional carbon monoxide, but that's not something that we can quite quantify. We have not had lab calibration efforts that can really back us up there. Although we know that it is happening, just not in what magnitude. But we do know that there's a deficiency of carbon monoxide relative to comets. So this means that the carbon monoxide may not have been present in large quantities in the icy planetesimals that formed Enceladus, or it just hasn't been hydrothermally processed. Next, I'm talking about some of the ambiguities in the rest of the spectrum. Also at mass 28, we have possibly some nitrogen and some C2H4, or a combination of nitrogen and hydrogen cyanide. But the problem is that given the mass spectrum, the INMS data has no way of telling us which is more likely. You can get the same exact spectrum from nitrogen and hydrogen cyanide as you would from C2H4. So then we look at what the possibilities of actually observing these are. What's the likelihood of seeing C2H4, for example? C2H4 is something that's not seen in comets, and it would be unlikely to be present in large quantities in these icy planetesimals. So it doesn't seem all that likely to be there. However, N2 can only be explained if there is a hydrothermal processing of ammonia. And hydrogen cyanide could be rapidly hydrolyzed to formic acid and NH3 in warm water. So if there's any warm water, it doesn't really make sense that the HCN would be there. So how do you have warm enough conditions to produce the nitrogen but cold enough to still retain the hydrogen cyanide? This is a problem that's not completely understood yet, but the coexistence of both of these, of all of these, could just indicate that the plume is accessing a mixture of materials that's undergoing different degrees of aqueous processing, that it's not just a simple one-step process, that there's a lot of things going on that we just don't completely understand. Means that Enceladus, again, is quite an interesting body to analyze. Here we go to slide 20, and a an in-depth comparison to comets, and I'm going to pass it off to Joe Westlake once again.
Thanks. Given that Enceladus is an icy body, as we mentioned, and that it's we haven't mentioned yet, but its deuterium to hydrogen ratio is actually very similar to that of a comet. It's instructive to make a comparison between the two. Shown here in this figure, the gray bars represent the range of observed cometary abundances from a review paper by Mama et al. In Comets 2. It's remarkable that the comparison yields such close results for almost all compounds studied. Elevated amounts of ethanol, CH3CHO, and hydrogen cyanide are observed in the plume, while hydrogen sulfide, H2S, and methanol, CH3OH, are significantly lower. It's also important to note that carbon monoxide, which is not shown here, is significantly lower in abundance in the plume than in comets. Carbon monoxide is generally seen as the most abundant non-water volatile in the comets. The abundances of CO2, CH4, C2H2, and C2H4 exceed the aqueous solubilities of these species, which provides further evidence that an aqueous medium coexists with other forms of these species, presumably in an ice overlying the medium, like Brian talked about. So we move on to the next slide, slide 21, where we present a possible process for the chemical evolution of volatiles in the interior. The production of these volatiles, specifically the hydrocarbons in a water-rock interface, could proceed by the process outlined here. Hydrogen is produced through the conversion of ammonia to molecular hydrogen and through the hydration of mineral components, which then react with CO and CO2 through a Fischer-Tropsch-like reaction. These reactions then lead to higher-order aliphatic or straight-chain hydrocarbons, as shown in the buildup in the center there. And I'll detail this process a little more in the next slide, so let's go to there. The Fischer-Tropsch synthesis process actually proceeds as shown in the cartoon or the schematic below. Basically what happens is a carbon monoxide, in this case, is attached to the surface. The oxygen is then attacked by molecular hydrogen, which then removes water from the system, leaving carbon bare on the surface. You then have two hydrogen molecules attack the carbon, which is at the surface, producing CH2. When you then have these two CH2s close to each other, you can produce something like ethylene, C2H4. This process is efficient and highly exothermic, and it produces both alkenes and alkanes. And it's important that the alkene to alkane ratio, the double to triple bonds, is different depending on the conditions of the reaction. The process is also possible to convert methanol and other alcohols to hydrocarbons through a similar process. So we then move to the next slide here. We've presented a direct comparison, which I believe is instructive, between Titan and Enceladus. In the red, you can see Titan, and in the blue, you can see Enceladus. Of course, the most striking difference is water at Enceladus versus methane at Titan, and N2 at Titan versus your Enceladus mix in the C2 group there. The other not quite as easy to see difference here is the hydrogen abundance. You can see the Enceladus spectrum shows very broad peaks indicating long-chain aliphatic hydrocarbons, whereas the Titan spectrum shows a hydrogen deficiency in that you see shorter, less saturated hydrocarbons. It's also important to note that in both cases we do see benzene, which was completely unexpected. If we then move to the next slide, slide number 24, we can see the abundance versus the carbon number for the Enceladus and Titan spectra. I've shown several different observed carbon numbers. You can see Enceladus, the Enceladus alkenes in green, the average cometary from the same reference of Buckley-Morvan et al., 2004, abiotic Fischer-Tropsch synthesis, from Potter et al. 2004, as observed at Earth, Titan, which is shown in orange, and a few plasma simulations from Imanakin and Smith in a lightish green and a teal there. You can see the abundances show different slopes depending on the hydrogen content and depending on the molecules that are produced. An Enceladus-like spectrum shows a very shallow slope, and you can see that the C2 through C5 groups of the Enceladus spectrum matches fairly well with what we consider an abiotic Fischer-Tropsch synthesis process. The Titan spectrum shows a much steeper slope, which is indicative of plasma-type processes and indicative of hydrogen loss as well. We then move to the next slide, which talks about the elemental abundance comparison. The most glaring difference here is between Titan and the Enceladus and the comet. You can see as Titan, you have the hydrogen deficiency I was speaking of. Hydrogen escapes through the upper atmosphere. You have a fairly reasonable amount of carbon. We have a very, very high amount of nitrogen at Titan. At Enceladus, you have a large amount of hydrogen, mostly because you have H2O. Carbon and nitrogen both show fairly similar to cometary values. The carbon is roughly 2 times greater in some cases than the minimum, but it fits well within that cometary range. So that's pretty reasonable. Seems that Enceladus shows a fairly good comparison in this case. So we then move to slide number 26, and I will pass it over to Ben Teolis, who will talk to you about the grain detection.
All right, thanks, Joe. Well, what I'm going to do here is augment our current discussion about the chemistry and composition of the Enceladus plume by addressing another very important question, and that is the structure of the plume. There have been a lot of measurements in this regard with remote sensing instruments, Cassini imaging and the ultraviolet spectrometer, which shows that the plume is not just this smooth thing, but the density is differentiated into jet-like sources that come off the surface. Brian discussed this a little bit. So you can actually see distinct sources there. And we also know from these measurements, as well as those of the Cassini dust analyzer, that there's a significant component in the plume, not only of water vapor, but also of ice grains. So It actually turns out that the INMS, and this was totally unexpected initially, the INMS actually can detect these ice grains in the plume as Cassini is passing through the different jets. And you can see that here in slide 26. I show, in this case, the mass 2, the signal at 2 Daltons versus time as we're making an approach of Enceladus. Scale on the bottom is the time from closest approach, and in this particular trajectory, we actually achieve closest approach to the surface slightly before coming into contact with the plume. So you can see there that there is a peak in the H2. You have a hydrogen background signal, which peaks slightly after closest approach as we pass through the plume. But then we also have these spikes in the signal, which occur throughout the encounter. And it turns out that these spikes actually show up in several different mass channels. Channels 1 corresponding to 1 Dalton, 2, 15, 16, 17, 25, 26, 27, 28, and 44. So you can see that there's a fairly complex mechanism here going on, which distributes the signal of ice grains in different mass channels. So why? There are two questions raised by this result. First of all, why do you have spikes? And then the second question is, and we'll get to this in a minute, why the signals are found in these particular mass channels and what that could mean. The first question is why the impact of the ice grain creates a spike is the most straightforward to address. And it turns out that if you have a molecule, so the grain arrives in the antechamber, hits the wall of the antechamber, vaporizes, and creates a plume of gas. And if the gas doesn't stick to the walls, it just bounces off the walls and goes through. It turns out you can do some simulations. We've done simulations to show that it only requires a couple of milliseconds for the gas to go through. And the highest resolution that we have in the time measurements of INMS is about 2 seconds between measurements. So by the time a single point is measured and you get to the next point, already you have sufficient time there for gases from the arriving ice grain to vaporize on impact, traverse through from the antechamber through the transfer tube to the ionizer and into the instrument, and hence the signals show up as brief spikes in the measurement. Now, the distribution of the signals into different mass channels could be an indication of the composition of the ice grains. That could be telling us something about what's contained in the grains. But the problem with that is that there are so many other possibilities which involve the interaction of the ice grain with the antechamber. First of all, which is an issue that Brian discussed before, the fact that these grains arrive at such a high speed, tens of kilometers per second into the ice grains, gives them sufficient energy to break molecular bonds. And so what could be happening is that you break some of the molecules and you have a chemical reaction as the dissociation products recombine inside the antechamber, which actually create different species which may not correspond directly to the contents of the grain as it originally arrived in the antechamber. And we don't have a very good understanding of how those processes might work. So at the moment, it is rather difficult to make an estimation of the composition. But presumably, the appearance of the signals in these different mass channels does tell us something about the composition, but that's certainly a question that remains to be answered. But if you go on to the next slide, slide 27, it actually turns out that we have a sufficient number of spikes in the different mass channels to put together a statistical analysis of the occurrence of the spikes versus time as Cassini traverses the Enceladus plume, and from that to calculate a density of the ice grains versus time during the encounter. And here in slide 27, I show two different encounters. The red line, just to give you a sense of scale of what's happening here, the red line actually shows the distance from Enceladus versus time. So you can see that the flyby, it's very quick. You know, you come in, the scale here on the right side is in terms of Enceladus radii. So we're quite far from Enceladus until very close to closest approach. And already, by the time you see these peaks in the ice grain density, we're fairly far outbound from Enceladus. But it turns out that in these cases, we've got a north-south trajectory, so we're actually traveling pretty well along the direction of the plume. So even as we move outbound from Enceladus, we do remain inside the plume's influence for a fairly long period of time. Now, one of the interesting thing here is that you see so much structure in the ice grain density. At E3, both at E3 and E5, you see at least three or four different peaks in the density at E3 and at least two at E5. And these seem to correspond to, if you match the peaks in density with the position over the Enceladus surface that where Cassini is positioned at the time at which we observe those peaks, they do seem to correspond pretty well with the jets observed in the remote sensing and the Cassini imaging results. So it would appear that we've tentatively answered one big question here, which is whether the jets are composed of high concentrations of water vapor or whether they actually result from a concentration of ice grains. And the answer would seem to be the latter. It would appear that the jets coming off of the surface actually correspond to a highly collimated source of ice grains coming off of the surface, which should tell us quite a bit about the physical mechanism which is actually causing the plume to be emitted from the surface. The force which is actually pushing these ice grains up off the surface may allow us to understand that mechanism a little bit better. So if you go to the next slide, I've addressed here the signal in a lot of different in the different mass channels, but the question is, what about the water mass channel itself at 18 Daltons, the signal of water, since these grains presumably should be composed primarily of water ice? And it actually turns out we don't see any spikes in the mass 18 channel. So the question is, why is that?
And the answer to that question is that water, unlike many of the other constituents that you see in the plume, water molecules actually have a significant binding to the surface of the antechamber. They stick to the antechamber. And as a result, water actually requires a much longer time, on the order of tens of seconds, as it arrives in the antechamber, to traverse from the antechamber to the ionizer to be detected. So you imagine a grain arriving in the antechamber. The water ice evaporates, and unlike the other volatile constituents of the grain, the spike, the burst of water vapor resulting from the evaporation is actually spread out over tens of seconds after the arrival of the grain, making its signal in the INMS so weak as compared to the water vapor background as to render the grain spike invisible water vapor channel. So, sorry? We'll get to that. So as you can see here, this is slide 28 now, here we've actually simulated the propagation of the water through the antechamber by dividing the surface of the antechamber and the transfer tube, that's this image shown on the upper left, into 1,300 surface elements and modeling versus time the water coverage stuck to each position on the surface versus time. So as you start clicking through the slide, just get my PowerPoint up here. So if you start clicking through the simulation, you can see over time, this is a simulation of the E3 Enceladus flyby. Over time, as the water coverage gradually fills the surface of the antechamber, and then only after that begins to propagate through the transfer tube. And then on the lower right, I'm showing the white line is the actual measured signal by the INMS at 18 Daltons. And on the bottom scale is the time from closest approach. And the red line, as you click through the simulation, is the simulated output from the transfer tube into the ionizer, which should correspond to the signal on the INMS, simulated output versus time. And as you can see, as the water vapor coverage propagates through the transfer tube and arrives at the ionizer, only then do you get an increase in the signal of the water. You then reach peak, and then the water signal has a slow, very slow decay. And it actually, it turns out that because of this sticking phenomenon of water inside of the antechamber and the transfer tube, the decay of the water versus time is much slower than that of the other volatile constituents. However, you notice here that in the actual result of the INMS, we have this fairly big spike here, about 120 seconds after closest approach. And that has to be due to the arrival of sudden arrival of water in the antechamber or in the transfer tube. However, it turns out that if the ice grain in the simulation is aimed at the wall of the antechamber, you get the same effect that I was just discussing. The ice grain vaporizes in the antechamber, and there's just too much distance between the antechamber and the ionizer for the water vapor to propagate through to the ionizer and show a sharp spike in the signal. So what we believe this is, if you go to the last slide, is actually an ice grain that entered into the antechamber at an angle such that it is aimed directly down the transfer tube and arrives almost at the end of the transfer tube to the ionizer, close enough so that there's not enough surface area on the transfer tube to slow down the propagation of the water through to the ionizer sufficiently to broaden the spike in the water vapor. So you actually can see the spike in this case because you had a grain that came into the antechamber at a very specific trajectory, such that if it could reach down to the end of the transfer tube. And just based on the amplitude of the spike, we can actually estimate the size of this grain as being a 6-micron grain. And then here I show in the last slide, one of the other results of the simulation is also an estimation of the water vapor density versus time and position in the Enceladus plume. And in the last slide, I'm showing here
the Cassini trajectory during the E3 flyby as compared to two of the sources on the surface, the two jet-like sources which Cassini flew directly through during this flyby. And at the bottom here, I'm showing the density of the plume as determined through the simulation multiplied by the square of the distance from the surface of Enceladus. And you can see that after the initial increase, the result is fairly constant with time and with distance from Enceladus, which does suggest that the water vapor component of the plume spreads uniformly as it propagates away from Enceladus. So that about wraps it up.
I think we can
go ahead and open up for questions now. It's science highlights of INMS from Titan and Enceladus.
That's great. Thank you very much. It was very interesting. Do we have any questions from our audience out there? I had a couple questions. I was wondering, first of all, we had an Enceladus flyby recently, E8, which was, I guess, the deepest penetration into the plume. Do you guys have any hints that you want to share with us about...
That was actually E7 a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm losing track here.
Actually, not as close to the surface of Enceladus, but closer to the surface where the plumes actually originate from. It was closest to the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually flying quite a bit slower than the last few flybys, so we saw densities, water densities, that were about what was expected given what Ben was just talking about, you know, relative to the surface, the square of the distance. But because of the lower velocity, we didn't see a signal that was quite as pronounced as before in amplitude. That data still has yet to be processed, but one thing from that is that it does show the same composition and structure. However, we're still trying to figure out the abundances of that composition and see if there's any differences from before.
Mm-hmm.
And then E8 was actually we just got the data from that last night, actually.
Okay.
We're quite far from Enceladus, and it's not optimal for INMS. Yet we still do see a significant signal from water, but not a whole lot from the other species. Of course, water is the most dominant, and even when we're not pointed directly towards RAM, we still see it, and that's actually something that's not quite understood. You know, when we're quite a bit off of the RAM direction, we're seeing a lot of water and sometimes the rest of the plume constituents, and the idea there is that we may be taking a bit of a cloud with us with the Cassini spacecraft.
That's an interesting idea. Have you compared these ice grain detections with the CDA? I know you talked about the remote sensing, the identification of the individual jets, but have you compared CDA's detection? Because I know on the recent flyby they were able to detect the individual jets.
Yes, we've compared with the CDA, and they actually see somewhat lower densities, but the thing is that they are not as sensitive to small grains as we are. So,
yeah.
And some of the other differences there, too, are in terms of the composition. They actually detect, what did we detect in the grains, Joe? Sodium?
They had some salts that we don't see. Salts
that we don't see, and we, in fact, wouldn't see because those things would stick very strongly to the antichamber. So
there's nothing contradictory.
Nothing contradictory. They're just different instruments.
Sure.
In fact, I was at a conference, an Enceladus symposium this summer, talking with some of the, it was heavily represented by CDA, and in fact, our detection of argon, they believe to be essentially us identifying the salts that we otherwise couldn't see, since the 4E argon is actually originally coming from potassium, which they can detect and do detect in their salt, their salty grain.
Interesting.
One thing I think people don't appreciate about INMS is the pointing sensitivity. You brought it up a couple times, but I mean, it really you really do need favorable pointing of the spacecraft in order to get your measurements. I know that somebody said earlier there were 20 Titan flybys where you actually obtained good data out of 70 or so, or 60 some odd that we've had so far. So that's kind of remarkable. But it's a very narrow field of view.
If I can comment on that, with the ion spectrum, the ions, especially at Titan, it's extremely important to have the correct pointing, because the ion spectrum can get very very sketchy if things come on and off. And it's also very important to be able to get a full flyby to get a look at the ionosphere for that sort of pointing. And our degree of acceptance is so low on that, but the amount of information that we can obtain from it is huge.
Yeah. Well, are there any other questions out there from our audience? Yes, people are kind of quiet, anticipating the Thanksgiving holiday. Well, thank you very much to all three of you. It was a great presentation, great graphics, and it was really informative. And I'm sure we'll have a lot of people either listening in today or downloading it in the future, so I appreciate it. To remind the audience, we have no Charm Telecon in December, and I'm lining up speakers for the next year. I'm going to be trolling the AGU meeting, looking for interesting science results. If you have any suggestions for future talks, topics that we haven't covered, just send them to the Charm leads or send them my way. And thank you, everyone, for participating.
This is Jane. I want to mention one thing.
Yes, ma'am.
We just posted on the Cassini website some beautiful pictures and movies of the Northern Lights, the aurora on Saturn.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
They just
went up on the website while the Charm Telecon was going on. There's two videos.
Oh, great.
Two videos. One of them is an explanation of the aurora by Dr. Andy Ingersoll, and that's a really fun one to get a little bit of background and some neat graphics. And then another one is just the ghostly aurora itself. So that's right on the front of the Cassini website, saturn.jpl.nasa.gov. And there's also some of our brand new pictures from the Enceladus flyby, E8, that happened on Saturday. So there's just all sorts of cool stuff on the website right now.
That's great, Jane. Thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah.
I saw the auroral images at the PSG.
Yeah, me too.
They're amazing. There's some
new
movies by ISS, and they're really spectacular.
Yeah.
I was thinking to try and get some of our auroral scientists maybe for January. But
that's a great, yeah. I loved the way Andy talks about that he's a weatherman.
Yeah. I'll try
and he likes weather at all different parts of the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
and it's really cute. So
yeah,
it's a great little video.
Oh, good. Okay, thanks
yeah.
for mentioning that.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I think that wraps it up. Again, thanks to the speakers, and we'll talk to the audience in January.
Okay, bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.